and welcome to Here in LA, Silver Lake Edition. Today, we talk with Danny Harunje. Danny is one of the smiling faces you'll see when you go to Cafe Tropical in Silver Lake on Sunset. He's tall, handsome, tattooed, and has the best energy, as you will soon hear. He and his partners bought the famous cafe not long ago to the delight of those who love the Cuban pastries and coffees, but for all the people who also use the back room for the 12-step programs. So we will talk about drugs, addiction, and being cool to those in need around these crazy streets of Hollywood, Silver Lake, and downtown LA. So please welcome Danny. Hey, everybody. I am here at the beautiful Cafe Tropical with Danny
Harunje.
Harunje.
Yeah, you did great.
That's how you say it?
That's how you say it.
Danny, you are from Ukraine.
I was born in Ukraine, yep. Born
what
in Kiev.
What city in Ukraine?
Kiev.
So is that the capital city?
It's the capital, yep.
That's the city that we're defending. Well, mm-hmm. I don't know if we're defending.
Yeah.
We're paying a lot of money
so that
Ukrainians can defend.
Yeah.
And that's a really vital, beautiful place, I hear.
It really is. It really is, yeah.
And so how has Kiev held up during all this?
I mean, it's held up. My mom's actually there right now because,
really?
My mom's there right now because we have a condo in Kiev and she went back. My grandma was living there. We had one family member that was still in, was my grandma, my mom's mom. And when the war started, she was like, don't worry about me. It's not that bad. Like, it's not as bad as they're making it out to be. And about a month in, she calls us and she goes, hey, I got to get out of here. Like, I don't feel safe. So we started finding organizations and seeing what we could do. And the way it worked when the war first began was there would be like humanitarian corridors that would open up where they would like safely get people out. So we found an organization that could get her to a border. We didn't know which border it was going to be. So they were like, hey, it's either going to be Romania, Poland or Hungary. It's going to be one of the three. And we can't tell you which one it is because then that would put everybody past and that we're rescuing, that we're getting out of there at risk. So basically, like, we can tell you once they get to the border. And so my mom and I were literally like, we were sitting there standing by. We got a call and she goes, hey, I think we're going into Hungary. That's what we heard. Right. So we go, okay. I was like, okay, mama, do we buy tickets now? Cause we're going to meet her at the border. She goes, I'd like to, but we don't know if they're going to make it. And I don't like, you know, we don't know if they'll make it or not through the border. So the second we got word that she was at the border, we got tickets to Budapest. We flew. We met her at the Ukrainian-Hungarian border, got her to Budapest, then got her to Germany, where she stayed with this family that was taking, they were basically taking in refugees and opened up their home. And she got her paperwork and her white card, which is basically like a temporary, like a 2-year green card, and came here as a war refugee and spent a year and a half here, and then she passed away from cancer. Yeah, but we got to have her here for a year and a half, and she got to live with my mom and hang out with my brother, and I got to hang out with her and take her around and take, you know, she got to try a bunch of food that she thought was very strange, and she goes, I don't know why you
like
guys
tacos and stuff.
She tried tacos. I mean, we took her to like, you know, I mean, we took her to Din Tai Fung. My mom loves Thai food, so like we took her to Din Tai Fung, Thai food, and everything she tries. She's like, this is kind of weird. Like, I don't know what you guys are doing here. Because, you know, it wasn't what she was used to.
So I heard that another reason that Ukraine has stood up to Russia,
uh-huh.
which, I mean, I grew up at a time where we all feared Russia
yeah.
and the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And we just every day thought some guy could just push a button and World War III, right?
Yeah.
And yet you guys have stood up to Russia like almost no problem.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like they have like gained any like serious footing
yeah.
in there. And so I heard that this is for a couple reasons. First of all, Ukrainian fighters are badass
mm-hmm.
mofos.
Yeah.
But also that there is a dynamic between Russia and Ukraine where you guys are friends.
Yeah.
You're brothers, you're relatives. Mm. And so it's hard for a Russian soldier to want to go to Ukraine to kick ass.
Yeah.
Because their heart is in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Is that true?
But yeah, I believe so. Well, you know, when I was born there, it was the Soviet Union, you know, so my first language was Russian. It was, you know, there was a, like, my nickname for a long time was Russian Danny because everybody would call it, because people didn't know what Ukraine was up until 3 years ago, just
That's
about,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
So, and then when the war began, I was like, all right, you can't call me Russian Danny anymore. We've got to switch it up. Yeah.
I may have first known you
yeah.
as Russian Danny.
Yeah.
How funny. So Ukrainians, their first language often is Russian?
Well, if it was a Soviet, yeah. If you were born during the Soviet era, everybody, all the countries, all the Soviet Union countries were they're like, you speak Russian now. This is your language. So it was illegal to speak your own language.
It was illegal?
It was illegal to speak in Ukrainian.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So did Granny like secretly teach you Ukrainian?
So I think it was my grandpa and my dad only spoke to me in Ukrainian, only, you know, and then my grandpa passed away when I was 6, right before we moved here. And then my dad passed away about 12 years ago. So those were kind of the last two. And then my grandma, the last few, I had two grandmas. They both passed away in a pretty small window of each other. One was 99. The other one was 78. And so the one that was 99, she's kind of started getting like late stage dementia stuff, and she would speak to me in Ukrainian as the dementia would come up.
Wow.
Yeah.
The brain is crazy.
Yeah, it really is.
So we're at Cafe Tropical, where you and some of these beautiful people behind us brought back to life right after COVID.
Yeah. Well, no, not right after COVID.
It was only like a couple months ago, right? So.
And you were the first one to break the story.
I broke it, I think, because
You saw it on my.
So I'm going to give you the props.
All right, I'll take it. Yeah.
But I was the first person to be like. I think this is news.
Yeah.
Only because I used to date a woman who used to go to the meetings in the back here.
Yeah.
Does that have a name?
So it's the meeting room. You know, some people call it the community room, the meeting room. We're trying to figure it out. We're still like, do we want to change the name, call it the welcome room, or do we want to keep it the community room? I mean, it's for the community. It's there for the, you know, for the community.
But she used to tell me, hey, I'm going to Cafe Tropical.
Yeah.
And that's what people say, right?
That's what people say, yeah.
So it's the Cafe Tropical community room right now until it gets turned into the Danny room.
Yeah.
The Russian Danny. Yeah. The Ukrainian Danny, whoever you want to call it. So a few months ago, we are right now at the end of July.
Mm-hmm.
So in June, you guys did this?
March.
In March, you did
March
this.
March, we opened, yeah.
And I'm actually glad because I wanted to podcast you then, but I'm actually glad we waited a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I can ask you this. How has it been?
It's going great. It's going cool. Yeah.
As planned?
Yeah, I think so.
You
yeah.
were like, okay, if we open, we're gonna make X amount of money. We're going to sell X amount of drinks, coffee. Everything's going to be cool.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Has it pretty much stuck
Yeah, it's
to
been
that?
Cool. It's been cool. The neighborhood, the community. We've opened. We got the community room going right away. That was a big part of a few of the guys that came together to help do this. It was a place that, you know, a lot of people, this is their first introduction to the 12 steps or to, you know, to this world. And an interesting thing, we were just talking about churches with this. So like, let's say you're trying to get sober and you're looking for somewhere to go and you're like, oh man, this is at a church and this is at a, you know, whatever. Like there's coming into the program. There's a lot of times have a sour taste in their mind with religious authority or with establishment. So to have something that's not actually at a church or something that's not at a community center or whatever, and it's a meeting in a cafe, was like appealing to a guy like myself when I first came around, and to a lot of other people. So it's a special place because not only is it a community coffee shop, it's been here for 49 years, but for the last 30 years has also hosted 12-step meetings in the back room.
You know, that's a great point because you're right, not everybody's totally down with religion.
Yeah.
And sometimes I hear criticism about 12-step because it is based a little bit, from what I hear, on giving it up to a higher power.
Yeah,
Which rubs some people the wrong way.
Rubs some people the wrong way, yeah. Usually people that don't know anything about what the 12, you know, what that is, and they're just like immediately, which was me for a long time, where I was like, oh no, here we are. You're going to try to, you know, sprinkle some kind of religious undertones in this thing, you know?
Yeah.
But it's really just about finding just a connection, just something bigger than you, and running with it.
Right. And so... So the meetings have been going gangbusters, right?
Meetings, yeah. We have more meetings now than before it closed in last November. We have 29 meetings a week.
And what did you have in the past? Like 20?
I think there was about 20-ish or so weekly, yeah.
29 a week?
Yeah.
So, hold on. I'm not good at math. That's four a day? Four to five a day?
Just about, yeah. Some days we have, yeah, some days there's more. So it's 7 a.m. meeting every day of the week, 7 days a week. Then there's an 8:30, 7 days a week. And then there's a few days. And there's different, we have different fellowships too. So it's not just, so it's the different, you know, so there's different groups that meet. There's Al-Anon, which is for the family of the alcoholic or the addict. We have a meditation meeting on Sundays, which is not 12-step associated, but it's just a meditation group that's donation-based. So people can come and figure out, get their meditation practice. We have a breathwork practitioner that comes on Sunday nights after that, and he does breathwork back there. And then we have Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous meetings as well.
This sounds very Silver Lake.
Yeah, yeah.
Breathwork, yeah, yeah, meditation. Yeah. But okay, if you guys don't go to the website, you're missing out, because Danny is very much of a punk rock guy. Incredibly handsome. You get handsomer every day.
Thank you.
What the
thanks,
hell?
Yeah, thank you.
You got tattoos. but am I wrong to present you as a punk rock soul?
I'm definitely. No, not at all.
You love
no,
punk
yeah,
rock.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so he's wearing like this cool throwback 80s pastel Los Angeles t-shirt. That looks so authentic, it looks like it's new.
It's not.
For a couple holes around the neck, it would look like somebody is doing a parody of it. Yeah. It's so right on the money. But it's one of those t-shirts you probably could have gotten at Venice Beach in the 80s for $3 for $5.
Yeah, three for five, yeah.
But I do see a lot of tattoos on you. I do see new tennis shoes. Mm-hmm. Some Supreme socks.
I put these on just for the podcast, just to look nice. Yeah.
So it's this nice dichotomy of super punk rock, but also you've grown up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
you know, you're doing good for yourself.
Yeah.
And so, but that, I bring this up because I feel like that is what this cafe is about, but for real, that's what the meetings are in the back.
Yeah.
Is that... Yes, you guys do meditation and breath work, woo-woo stuff, but this isn't Santa Monica.
No, no.
The people who probably come through here are all kinds of people that you would see on Hollywood Boulevard, or here we are on Sunset and Silver Lake. I'm sure some people might have some crystals in their pockets, but also some people might be in here because of crystal meth.
Yes.
And so it's all the things that I love about Hollywood, which is the broad spectrum of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of what you think about back there?
100%, yeah. And what's funny is I have a few friends that I'm a Hollywood, I love Hollywood. You know, I love it. I love Hollywood Boulevard. I love I love the characters, I love the people, I love all of it. I love the strip, you know, when I first got sober, I was kind of running around getting loaded in Hollywood, and then I got sober and I moved back there for a few years and I loved it. I love walking my dog, shooting photos. There's something real special about it.
It's for sure my favorite street.
Yeah.
And in a perfect world, I would set up like an old-fashioned-y camera, like with the curtain around it, and just take pictures of the tourists and the people who are there.
Yeah.
Because, well, first, the lighting is always great.
Uh-huh.
But you get such a wide variety of people. But I feel like this block gets that, too.
Yeah, we do.
We're right next door to Silver Lake Lounge.
Uh-huh.
We're across from Silver Lake Ramen, Silver Sun Liquor.
Silver Sun Liquor. We got Silver Sun Liquor. We got Lasorda across the street. We got, Bodega Park. There's a lot of fun places. You know, there's a lot of fun places right over here. Silver Lake Lounge is actually about to go have, they have new owners coming in on the 1st of August. So they're going to,
Is that good news or bad news?
I think it's good news. I think it's,
The last owners.
No, they were great. But I think it's good. You know, these guys want to make it a little more fun, have some more daytime parties and stuff.
Oh, really?
So we're excited. They came to us and we're excited to have them in the neighborhood.
That place always sounded good inside, but it was so small that I would think it would be hard to make money there, because it seems like they're all brand new bands that may not have a following yet.
Uh-huh.
So you got to sucker your friends to come see you play. Yeah. And that's got to be a hard way to make money.
Mm-hmm.
So the day parties make sense.
I think day parties, and then they're going to have some more DJs there and stuff, and kind of try to bring some.
Are you into the DJ world?
I was for a while. You know, I think the older I get, the harder it is for me to go out to anything at night. But yeah, I definitely was.
Also, what's unique about this area is, even though the people who go to, because Los Globos is right down the
Los
block
Globos
too,
is right there, yeah.
Even though the kids that frequent these places are young and vibrant, and they get termed hipsters and all that, I don't know if they can afford to live right around here.
Yeah.
Is that the case too?
I think so. You know, I don't know. It's so weird because living anywhere in Los Angeles, I don't know how people afford to live anywhere in Los Angeles anymore. You know,
you unless gotta get lucky,
like,
right?
Yeah, unless you're in a rent controlled place where you've been for, you know, 10 plus years, you look at rent prices, and you're like, this is insane. So we get a lot. I mean, a lot of the regulars are people who we have a lot of people that have been in the area for a long time, that have been here for years. You know, people that either bought here 20, 30 years ago, you know, when houses were 300,000 for houses that are now going for 2.5 million.
Right.
So it's, you know, so it's an interesting mix, you know?
So, okay, let's talk about the cafe real quick,
yeah.
A little bit more, especially the clientele, because I would assume if you have 27 meetings,
mm-hmm.
the bulk load of the coffee drinkers are going to be coming from there. Is that true?
Not, you know, that's the thing. We didn't know. We're going into it. I also would think that. I was like, oh, we're going to have a lot of people. We get we get a good amount of people that come from the meetings, you know, that'll come, that'll hang out, that'll get something beforehand. But a lot, you know, a lot more people just from the neighborhood, from the community, people that just want to come in and get a good cup of coffee or breakfast sandwich will come in and they'll be like, you know, they'll be amazed by the quality of the breakfast sandwich or by the food, how good the food's gotten since we've taken over a few months
ago. So it's even better than before.
Yeah.
Danny.
Yeah.
Because it was good before.
It was good before. When, you know, you'll love this because I'm a nerd for LA stuff, you know,
yeah.
and Jonathan Gold was one of my favorite, you know,
of course,
one of the best. Yeah, I mean, yeah. If not the best, you know,
the best,
hands down.
We can say
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
No disrespect to the
yeah.
others.
Yeah, the best. But I was looking, you know, and I was kind of nerding out, and I was looking at some of his lists, and one of the lists that came up was like his top five sandwiches in LA, and the Cubano from here was on one of those.
Was it really?
Yeah.
So this is better than what Jonathan Gold put on his list. Okay, what's in a Cubano? A Cubano sandwich.
Cubano sandwich.
Is that
sandwich.
What you're saying?
Yeah, uh-huh. So there's pork, ham,
like
pickle,
pork?
Shredded pork.
Oh, shredded.
Shredded pork,
okay.
Ham, we have pickles, mustard, there's a garlic sauce in it, Swiss cheese, and it's pressed on a Cuban roll.
A Cuban roll. How is that different than a croissant?
So it's a different, it's totally different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm completely ignorant to the food world.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
You
got to
come in and have one. You got to come in and try one.
Well, if you're saying it's better than what Jonathan Gold said, I got to try that. Because he never missed, right?
He never missed.
Well, yeah.
We did get all the recipes. We did get all the stuff. That came with the cafe. We got the head baker. We got the man. We got the stuff.
Can we talk about this for
a
second?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so there was old ownership, and now there's new ownership.
Yeah.
So the old ownership, why did they throw in the towel?
So, you know what's interesting? So right when we came in, because we started getting people that come in, and people will tell us, oh, I used to, you know, people will come in, and they say, hey, I worked here in 1978. I was 12 years old, and I worked serving ice cream here out of the window over there, you know? And when people have stories like that, I'll stop what I'm doing. I'll be like, wait, I want to hear more about that, you know?
Good.
So I've kind of gotten some story of the, I've gotten a good amount of the backstory of this place, you know, like who there was originally owned by Cubans in the, you know, in the 70s. And it was an ice cream place. It was ice cream and bakery. And one of the cool things is that Ed, when we came in here, Ed was like, hey, because Ed has an ice cream company called Milk Cult. So right when he came in, he goes, dude, we got to bring back tropical ice cream because it's a thing. That's how it started, you know. And so we brought back tropical ice cream on Friday nights. We do wings and ice cream here. And Ed makes insane different ice cream flavors, and we have that. And so we incorporate.
So it's like fruity flavored ice cream?
All kinds. I mean, it's just last 2 weeks ago, we did a croissant. He did a croissant ice cream.
So when I watch Iron Chef. Uh-huh. Did you ever watch Iron Chef?
I haven't in a while. It's been a minute.
Sometimes they would have an ingredient and they'd say, make a four-course meal with, I mean, not entirely of that ingredient, but based around that.
Mm-hmm.
People would always make ice cream, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. That's what he's capable of doing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So Friday nights.
Friday nights. 6 till later, about like 10 to 10.
If you want something unique,
mm-hmm.
something that you probably haven't tasted before. And do you still serve out of that window?
We do we were doing the window, and at first we're like, we're just gonna do window and outside seating, but we open it up inside, and then we do some outdoor tables too.
Well, it's really beautiful what you've done inside. Like I feel like you've redecorated the place.
We've redecorated a bit. You know, we kept like we came in and the last so it was the Cubans that had it in the 70s. Then they sold it to in the 80s. It was this guy that came back from, he served at some war and he came back and he was a, he got some kind of money from that, and he came in and owned it with his wife. And there was a baker that worked for them. There was a baker that worked for him whose name was Donato. And Donato was the guy that ran it for and he managed the coffee shop for him for a while. And when Jeff, the husband, was like, hey, I'm over this, they actually gave the cafe to Donato, who managed it. They said, here you go. This is yours.
What?
Yeah. He was the one that opened it up in the early 90s to 12-step rooms. Oh. And allowed the 12-step meetings to come to use one of the spaces here. And he was just as long as they purchased, didn't bring outside food or drinks, so purchase something from the cafe, which was beneficial to it was beneficial to the meetings and beneficial to the cafe because it got people coming through here.
Right.
And he passed away in about 2015. And when he passed away, his brother took over it for a year. And then the last owner before us was a guy that the guy that owned El Cochinito. So he was in here. Yeah.
So maybe the Donato room.
Yeah, the Donato room. So we named our drip coffee the Donato, and then we brought back the whole, one of the top requests we had was the whole guava cheese pie. So we named it the Donato slice too. So
I think you did give me
I gave you a slice. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah, cool.
So Donato was gifted this place.
Yeah.
And he did the right thing.
He did the right thing.
He honored that gift.
Mm-hmm.
Was he in the program too?
He wasn't in the program. So story has it is that he had, you know, and there's no way of confirming it, but from what I remember hearing is that he had a family member or somebody that he lost to an overdose, or he lost to addiction. And that was like his service to the community was he wanted to help and keep and have a space where people could meet.
Al-Anon, because I dated this girl for a long time who loved going here.
Yeah.
And we were only a mile away from here. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. I was like, am I going to be late for this interview? And I'm like, I'm a mile away.
Yeah.
I think I can make it. But you never know with Sunset.
You never know, yeah.
But she loved going here. Mm-hmm. We live in East Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy that this is only a mile away. Mm-hmm. But there's other places to go on that side.
Mm-hmm.
But one was a church. Mm-hmm. And she's got no problems with the church. But I think it's just the group of people that congregate here.
Yeah.
It's just a different situation in all of L.A.
Yeah.
Would you say that?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. In that, you'll see movie stars, rock stars, people who are houseless.
Yeah.
And everybody in between. And everybody's focused. I don't think anybody's like asking autographs of people.
No,
right?
That's one of the most beautiful things about, to me, that's always been about like the various programs, the various 12-step fellowships, is that like it doesn't matter who you are, or what you've done. If you're there and you want to get help, people are going to drop what they're doing to help you. And it doesn't matter what your, you know, what credits you have or how you smell or whatever. People are going to come together. And if you need some, you know, if you're hungry, they're going to get you something to eat. They'll get you a cup of coffee. They're going to hang out with you and they're going to show up. And if you need a ride to somewhere, they'll come and pick you up. And it doesn't matter if you live, you know, if you lost your license in a DUI and you're a big actor that can't drive himself or lost all of his money, or if you're somebody that's literally living in a homeless shelter on, you know, in downtown, or somebody will come, you know, there'll be a person that's there to help. And then the interesting thing about that, you know, and everyone's like, wow, you guys are so good. Like, you guys are so good to do that. And well, like, the truth is, like, our lives depend on doing that. Like, without that part, then our chances aren't that great. So it's such a big part of our lives to do that.
That's a great point because do you know the YouTuber German in Venice?
No.
He's this guy who came here in the 80s. He's mm-hmm. got this thick Austrian accent, mm-hmm. although I think he's German. You Europeans always confuse me.
Yeah, it's all.
He just did a video about Santa Monica,
uh-huh.
and specifically the Third Street Promenade, mm-hmm. and how it's disaster town down there. And I think it's because they didn't take care of the poorest of that area.
Yeah.
And when you don't take care of the poor people and one storefront closes and never reopens,
mm-hmm.
and the guy next door to it never reopens, and the landlord doesn't lower the rent,
mm-hmm.
you end up having a Third Street Promenade that's mostly empty now.
Yeah.
And so to the east of us, I'm a little bit worried about this side of your street.
Yeah.
Because those used to be like super trendy eateries,
mm-hmm.
which I guess there was too many of them on this street or whatever. But there's like three in a row that are shuttered right now. Mm. And it makes me worried because I don't want that happening anywhere in LA. But especially where there's a vibrancy.
Mm.
You'd think that that's where anything could thrive.
Mm-hmm.
Do you worry when you see shuttered places?
I guess I should, you know, but not, but no, not really. I mean, you know, I think that we got something. I mean, I think we got something really cool here. We have there's a Persian restaurant that just opened across the street, Azizam, that's real cool, and they got some real cool fun stuff happening.
Uh-huh.
And just this whole little the whole little corner, the corridor, you know, we got Moon Juice over there. We have the UC. I just found this out like last week, the UCB, that's UCB over there.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. That their school is out over there. I thought that it was just some building that went out of business that gets vandalized because I didn't see it open at nights. But it's that's where the UCB school is.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they'll come in here and they'll be all loud and screaming. And I'll be like, where did they find these kids? They're
coming. You also have same over there.
We have same,
are
which
you a
is
fan
great.
Of,
I am, yeah.
Because when I worked in Beverly Hills, they had Tuk Tuk Thai.
Uh-huh.
And this is their second location.
And there used to be a really good Filipino restaurant there, too, called Mamsir.
Wait a second. Is that the same? You know the Elliott Smith wall?
Uh huh.
They had, I thought that was Mamsir there.
Was it there? Yeah.
But they shut down. Maybe they moved over here. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. You know what? This is about Silver Lake.
Yeah. Uh huh. It is.
We were going to make it about something else, audience, but we're such nerds about this
corner.
It's
true. Well, you know, it's funny. And so years ago, right? So, and I think it's great that you were like, hey, let's meet at 420, you know? So I had a very, very short lived blogging career, which when I was like in my early 20s, I had a blog called My Nugs, where I would review different weed stuff.
Uh-huh.
Where I would review, this is like before the medical marijuana thing really blew up, you know?
Yeah.
And Tony saw me doing this and reached out and was like, hey, I want to do something for LAist and bring you on. So for maybe 6 months, I had a little LAist thing called I think it was called the lunchtime, like the lunchtime bowl or something. And then I interviewed, and then there was a few interviews that I did for LAist, and one of them was the $5 guy, who's a big Silver Lake
fixer. So happy you brought him up.
Yeah.
I was talking to him right before COVID because mm-hmm. He had the most beautiful tent.
Yeah.
Because he was in front of the 4100 Club.
He was in front of 4100.
And 4100 got rid of they had these cool ceiling drapes that made it look very like North African, like Moroccan.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, they decided to take those down. Mm-hmm. And he dumpster dived those and turned that into the most glorious tent. And we talked for a little while, and then I never saw him again. Have you seen him?
I've seen him. Yeah, I saw him pretty recently.
So he's okay.
Yeah, he's pretty good. They shut. You know, they actually a few years ago now. He had an encampment right on the other side, right where the bridge is that goes over. What is that, Myra or whatever?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
The one on Sunset, and he had an encampment right over there, and they came and cleaned that up. And I'm a part of a nonprofit called Feed the Street, so we came together and helped get some funds and get him set up.
Danny.
Yeah.
You angel.
But he's I love him.
I love
Eddie
him too.
Eddie Spaghetti. Yeah.
And what's great about him was I interviewed him for Los Angelino.
Uh-huh.
Rest in peace, Los Angelino. I feel the same way about LAist.
Well, yeah.
They ain't going to be reviewing any butts these days. R.I.P. I was like, Danny, for a guy without a house, you always look cool. You never smell bad. Like, you dress better than I do. And he goes, I do. And I go, how? How do you stay so clean? Walking these streets, dumpster diving. And we called him the $5 guy because he would find stuff and then sell it for $5 bucks. Which would keep him
alive. Was originally, and this is what, you know, and I just remember this recently. So, and this is, I got this form when I interviewed him for, you know, however many years ago that was. So I was originally the $500 guy where he used to sell chihuahuas for $500. He would breed chihuahuas and sell them for $500.
Whoa.
Yeah. And then he goes, and then I sold out of chihuahuas and I go, what am I going to sell next? So he goes, this is much easier. So he would find stuff dumpster diving and would sell it for $5 because you can sell anything for $5.
So he told me that he would wash up in McDonald's.
Oh.
So you found him like an actual place to live?
We found, we helped him get some stuff because he lost everything he had. We came up with a little bit of money for him and got it for him. And he had a van that somebody gave him, and he found somewhere to park the van, and he was living in it for a while. I don't know if he's there anymore, but I'll see him riding his bike down, you know, riding his bike down or walking down Sunset.
So
and
great.
I'll always pull over and.
Let's plug this nonprofit again.
Okay.
What's it called?
Feed the Streets.
Feed the Streets. So is it feedthestreets.com?
Feed this. We have an Instagram. I think it's feedthestreets.info. I should know our website, right?
We have an Instagram.
Yeah. If you go to Feed the Streets LA on Instagram, that's kind of where you see where our weekly activations are. We started around COVID. We started right around the COVID time because a lot of the different organizations that were taking volunteers couldn't take volunteers because it was a risk. And I volunteered for this organization called Community Health Project Los Angeles, who does the Hollywood Needle Exchange, and they do outreach, and they do some amazing work. And I volunteered for them for years because I was a participant. I would go and I would get clean needles there in Narcan when I was getting loaded in the 2010, 2000, between 2010 and 2015 when I was an IV drug user. And I would go to them and get needles, and then I volunteered there. COVID hit and they go, we can't have any more volunteers. It's a risk. So a group of us came together and we're like, well, we have all these people that we know that are on the street from when we were doing outreach. Why don't we just start gathering people and we'll start bringing them stuff, you know? And we would call to action. Hey, anybody have, if it was hot out, we'd say, hey, anybody want to donate, you know, $5? We're going to go and we would go and get a bunch of waters, put it, refrigerate them, go and hand out waters. If it was cold outside, we'd go and say, hey, you got an extra coats, we'll take them. And we'd go and we'd give them to the unhoused in Hollywood, or we'd give them to the unhoused on Skid Row. And at the same time, my friend Hassan was starting this organization called Feed the Streets on the West Side, where they would make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and roll cigarettes and go hand them out on Venice Beach on the boardwalk to the unhoused there. So we kind of put our heads together and we would do these monthly supply drives where people would come and they'd give us different hygiene, you know, different hygiene stuff, water, a granola bar, whatever. We'd pack them all up and we'd go and we'd hand them out. We'd put together anywhere from 300 to 500 and go and then hand those out. And I came one day to the supply drive and I go, hey, could I get 300 packs? And he goes, you have 300 people that you, where are you going to take them? I was like, Hollywood. He goes, you got 300 people there? I go, I got more than that. And I'm like, we got 150 that we know on a first name basis, you know? And he was like, can I come with you? And I said, sure. And he came over and he's like, well, rather than us doing supply drives on the West Side and then one on the East Side, why don't we just start doing the supply drive in Hollywood where we're giving the stuff out? So we had started having volunteers show up there and people donate stuff. And then as time went on, we're like, hey, we should just start feeding here. So we started feeding and we feed two, you know, and we started getting so many volunteers and donations in Hollywood every Sunday that we were like, we should break this up and start taking stuff to downtown because there's never a shortage of unhoused people in downtown to feed. True. So we started doing an activation in Hollywood on every Sunday evening and one in downtown every Sunday evening. We got our 501c3 about 3 years ago. And then we then added an activation every Tuesday and Thursday morning on Skid Row. We do coffee and donuts. We do MacArthur Park. We feed about 120 every Friday afternoon.
Wow.
And then we do, and then we started to Feed the Streets New York, where we had some friends move out to New York. So now they're doing, we have two monthly activations, and now we're starting to do a cold brew or coffee and bagels once a week in New York now in Tompkins Park.
Well, first of all, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
This is, we don't hear about this.
Yeah.
Why do you think people don't talk about this?
I don't know. I don't know.
That's such a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you don't have a problem raising money or getting food or coffee or anything like that.
It's definitely,
you
know,
sometimes
we have some difficulties, but we have, you know, I mean, we have like literal angels that just came on that, you know, we have people that bake stuff at their house weekly. You know, we have people that made, we have a few different organizations. Like we were here, we were brewing the coffee and helping. We were brewing pots of coffee for the Skid Row coffee and donuts. What's it called? I'm blanking on the donut friend. They donate donuts to us to hand out. We had Just What I Needed, the gluten-free place in Frogtown. They were donating stuff to us for Feed the Streets. We had La Colombe that was providing us with coffee before. So we've had a few different organizations, a few different restaurants that donate stuff and help us out. We've had some people. We just did a We just did a fundraiser with Sebastian Gladstone Gallery that's kind of over by, that's on Santa Monica and Western, and they did a, Sayer Gomez and Sebastian Gladstone came together and got a bunch of artists that, that donated pieces, and we opened it up, and it was like gallerists that had held art by these well-known artists that, that they weren't selling, so we came and we raised, I don't know the exact dollar amount, but I know that we did really well. So we're going to, it's going to, you know, that's going to keep us going for at least a few months.
This is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Were you always this kind of a person where you wanted to always help?
I think I wanted, you know, something where like my mom will tell me that sometimes. She says, you know, you were always, she's like, even when you were all messed up, you were still, you still wanted to help people. I go, yeah, wanted, maybe wanted to. I wasn't doing too great of a job doing that. I think it was, yeah, I think there was always like some want for that. There was a drive for, you know, for.
And you're, so you're spiritual.
Yeah.
So this is my theory about why it feels good when you help. I'm a Christian, for better or for worse. I feel like when I am doing something good, like right now I'm feeling really good talking to you, talking about this. I feel like we've opened a space that the goodness from above, I'll call it the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, the whole, I love, yeah, I'm
where it's like, oh, I'm supposed to be here. And so it kind of like channels through us.
Yeah.
And when, even if I give like a guy a dollar and you can tell that he's like, oh my God, thank you. Like I'm just a conduit through which goodness can come.
Yeah.
Do you think something along those lines too?
1,000,000%. 1,000,000%.
And it just, I mean, it's not a selfish good feeling.
No.
It, because it's fleeting, you know, in 10 minutes, something bad can happen.
Yeah.
But in that moment, it's like, wow, I actually do have a purpose for this moment, and that's to pass on whatever blessings I have right now to somebody who doesn't. And if you can do that for every week, well, that's a great Sunday, right?
Yeah.
You probably feel kick-ass on Sundays.
Yeah, it's real cool, yeah. It's interesting because I haven't been, because I was there every Sunday for however many years, and then now I've kind of like, I'm more on the back end, you know, I'm trying to find various organizations, you know, that they'll donate stuff. We have one thing that whenever the summer's hit, it's always hard for, there's, our number one expense is water, you know, so we're always looking for different, for different water brands to donate water to us, you know, we're always trying to, Miracle Seltzer has been really kind to, they've really, really helped us out a lot. And then last year we had a big donation from Liquid Death and Dr.
Really?
Yeah. Dr. Bronner's came on and they've been coming in and like just literally like we'll be going down this Sunday to or this Wednesday to San Diego to get a bunch of stuff from Dr. Bronner's because they give us so many. They give us soaps, toothpaste. They give us all hygiene kits, hairbrushes. They do. I mean, they're just like, it's amazing how much Dr. Bronner's does.
And I hear those are the things that people steal the most from grocery stores.
Yeah.
And that's why they're not putting cages on them. And like it's like not the booze.
Yeah.
But the soap.
The soap. Yeah.
And it's like we're not doing something right.
Yeah.
So let's go back to water real quick.
All right.
Because as an Uber driver, I drive everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And like you said, these houses are now worth millions and millions of dollars, which means the city is making more money on property tax and things like that. And yet, I feel like water should be an easy thing to give to the people. Be it water fountains or just pop-up showers or like, I think it's easy. Am I crazy? Am I being naive that it would be easy for the city? Like, for example, if Mayor Bass came to you and said, Danny, I need your help. How do we get water on every mile? There should be a public water spot. Just a spigot that anybody can use that could fill their water bottle or their jug.
Well, we already have them with the fire hydrants. You know, there's a very easy way that it already exists.
Is that drinkable water?
I don't know if it's drinkable water, but I'm sure there could be a filter put on there.
There you go.
Be a very easy. And think about Brita, you know? Think about, there's a easy, where there's a will, there's a way. There's always a way,
so,
you know?
So we have all these water pipes going through the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, and you're the expert to ask this about, I think the fear that some people have is if you feed these people on the beach, they're always going to stay on the beach and they're never going to get better and it's only going to get worse.
Yeah.
Somebody from Texas is going to get on a bus and come out here and we're going to have a gazillion homeless people. How would you respond to that fear?
Well,
especially
I mean,
needles. If you're giving them needles,
yeah.
I'm sure that's going to freak out a lot of people.
It freaks out a lot of people. And, you know, and you get a lot of the, you get a lot with the whole world of harm reduction, you get a lot of people that are saying, oh, you guys are the problem. You guys are, you're what's, you're why you're enabling people to keep using. You're, oh, you're giving them Narcan. Oh, yeah. So you're, rather than giving them a bed or a shelter or somewhere to, you know, that you're the ones that are, you're a part of the problem. You know, that's, I had to learn how to really restrain that, the online comment, you know, because I'd be up at night, you know, 2-3 in the morning, I'm sitting there typing, you know, these responses to some kid or whoever it is, you know, and like plain and simple, what I tell them is like, hey, you can't, you know, with the world of harm reduction specifically, right? It's like we tell them, hey, you can't get somebody into treatment that's not alive, you know,
right.
And that's the winning argument there, you know, where you say, hey, without people be having access to naloxone, Narcan, without them having access to clean needles, without them having access to resources to Hep C and HIV testing, right? Then they're spreading disease and they're gonna die. And then your own family members, though, the same ones that you're saying, oh, we're not giving it a chance, then they're coming home and they're HIV positive, they have Hep C, they're spreading diseases, they're not able to provide, you know, their veins are shutting down, they're getting gangrene, they're getting all kinds of infections from sharing needles, from sharing. Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, a lot of the people think that it's just for drugs, that when Clean Needles Now started, and it was just a little over 30 years ago, when Clean Needles Now started in Los Angeles, the HIV, it was single-handedly, the HIV case numbers started going down. It was like the only thing that really stopped HIV from spreading was the needles. It was needles and condoms becoming accessible and free on the streets.
And you can decline any of these questions. Have you ever had to use Narcan for yourself?
Yes, I've had it used on me. Yes.
Okay.
Uh huh.
Thank you for being here to answer this question. I Ubered the sweetest girl, maybe 23 years old, pink colored hair, who told me that she is still super addicted to fentanyl, and if it wasn't for the fifth can of Narcan that her boyfriend found in the apartment, she'd be dead, because she went through four. She was still not responding.
Yeah.
He scrambled to find. He was like, I know there's one more in here somewhere. Finds it. She comes back to life. She said, though, that once you do that, the way that the Narcan works, whatever that chemical is in there, It shuts down all pleasure centers. And she said, I wanted to rip my skin off of my bones. Is that the experience?
Yeah, 100%. So the way that it works is this: the naloxone blocks your, it's not all pleasure receptors, but it blocks the opioid receptors in your body, right? So what it does, and it temporarily blocks them. Right. So basically you have the opiate that you're taking, whether it be a Vicodin or whether it be heroin, which is pretty unlikely that you're finding these days, you know, you're smoking opium, or whether it's fentanyl or whatever variant of that, you know, you're taking it, and what it does is it bonds and it sticks onto the opioid receptors, and it tells your body, whoa, this feels good, and it slows down your breathing, and it slows down, you know, and that's where a lot of the people, that's where the overdoses come from, where it slows down your breathing, your body doesn't know how to react, everything slows down a bit, and then you go into cardiac arrest, right? When you go into there, then what happens is, if you have the naloxone present, you bring it and you administer the Narcan naloxone. Usually it's in the, nowadays, it, more likely than not, it's usually nasal. So it's just a spray. It's kind of like an Afrin nasal spray. It's one quick squirt up the nose. Yeah. Uh-huh. And what that does is it goes over those opioid receptors and it blocks that, and it blocks it temporarily from about 45 to 80 minutes.
Okay.
In the time where then hopefully your body will get shocked and will then come back to, we'll come back from it. Now with the stronger opiates like fentanyl or carfentanil or the stronger stuff, where before one dose of the Narcan would bring you out of it, now we've seen people getting 2, 4, 6. We've heard of people getting eight doses of Narcan to come out of it. A lot of the time, you know, it's also recommended that you do rescue breaths between, to help get it into the system.
It's like CPR kind of stuff?
Not CPR.
Mouth to mouth?
Not CPR, mouth to mouth, yeah. rescue breath specifically. Not CPR, because people in that moment will panic and they'll try to do CPR and they don't know how to CPR and they end up breaking somebody's ribs and making it worse than it could be. So basically,
so
rescue
mouth
breath.
To mouth some people, mouth, probably.
Mouth to mouth, yeah. And you could use a shirt if you're if you feel comfortable doing that. You
I
know?
Mean, if I'm trying to save their life, I'll get over it. You know?
Yeah, you basically, and the simple, you know, the easiest way of explaining it is you put a shirt or you put something over their mouth, you breathe in. You want to breathe in for them, and you want to let them breathe it back out. And you breathe in for them, and you want to let it back out. And you, if you have more of the Narcan naloxone, you want to administer that. And you do that while, if there's somebody around, you tell them, hey, call 911.
Right.
And when they call 911, you don't say, hey, there's a person here that's overdosing. Hey, there's somebody here that's loaded. You just say, hey, I'm with somebody that's not breathing. And you keep it just at that, because we see it less and less now. But before, if you would say, hey, I'm with somebody that's overdosing, it would take them longer to come.
No.
Or a lot of the time rather than sending EMS, they would send law enforcement. So then law enforcement comes in and they go, hey, what are you doing here with them? Why are you? And then it's this whole thing, you know? Luckily in California, there's a Good Samaritan law. So if you call, it doesn't matter what's going on. If you're calling and you're going to save somebody's life, then there's nothing that can be done to you for that.
You've got presidential immunity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Temporarily.
Yeah, temporarily.
So, okay, when you had this treatment done to you and you came back to life, by the way, thank you, God, for letting Danny come back to life. Did you feel this terribleness?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Where you go, your body, because the way, so you if you've been using it for a while, you have the withdrawal symptoms from it, right?
And that's immediate withdrawal symptoms.
Right. And that's the reason why a lot of people keep using opiates, is because to combat those withdrawal symptoms, right?
Yeah.
So what ends up happening when you get hit with that Narcan is you immediately go into the worst withdrawal that you can.
Right.
But there's no amount of opiate that you can do over it that'll make you feel better.
None.
Because those receptors are blocked.
So I because I'm Mr. Jokester, mm-hmm. I was like, so should there be a joint on every can of Narcan?
Yeah.
And she's like, it wouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
But you're saying it probably wouldn't even help.
Well, I mean, maybe, you know, maybe it would have been.
The joint's compared to what.
Yeah, I mean, with
the,
you know,
there.
Yeah.
So what would you recommend? So, okay, so not only do I have to save this person's life, but when they pop back to life, they're feeling horrible.
They're feeling horrible.
So what's the,
you
how
want to
do
tell
I support
them, hey,
them in that?
You support them by letting them know what happened, saying, hey, this is what, you know, hey, this is what happened. You were overdosed. This is how many doses of Narcan were used. You let them know. You ask them if there's anything, you know, if there's anything that they need, anything you could do for them. Like, hey, is there anything I could do?
So
you want to keep them calm. You don't want to go, what the hell's wrong with you? Why'd you do that? You know, you idiot. You want to be, you want to be calm. You want to be that, you know, you want to let them know exactly what happened. And you want to let them know, hey, if you use more opiates, this is where we see people die, right? So let's say that girl fell out. Her boyfriend gives her the sixth dose is the one that brings her back, right?
Yeah.
She comes out of it and she feels like she's dying, because that's literally what you feel like, you know? And she goes, oh, man, I got to get well. I got to get mine. So then she starts using again. She doesn't feel anything because the opioid receptors are blocked. But when it wears off 45 to 60 minutes later, it hits you all at once. And then you fall out again, and now you don't have any of that Narcan to help save you, because you just used it all.
So do hospitals know how to handle these people?
Yeah.
So, okay.
Hospitals, paramedics, most agencies, you know, now like even people who work at libraries, people that work for Department of Mental Health, any one of these organizations are all getting trainings pretty regularly on how to administer Narcan, how to spot an overdose, what to do in the case of an overdose, how to react, how to.
So once we bring these people back to life and give them a nice hug, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if hugging is good or bad. Mm-hmm. We say, we got to call the ambulance right away, because you have to go to the hospital, right?
You don't have to. No, you don't
really?
Have to. No, I mean, you don't have to go to the hospital. Yeah.
The hospital's not the better place to be?
The hospital.
Did you go to a hospital?
Yes. I came to in the hospital. I mean, the hospital is definitely the better place to be, because they'll make sure that you're okay, and they'll, you know, and they'll release you when you're ready.
And they'll give you something.
They'll give you something, yeah.
That's not the stuff that got
well,
you there.
Yeah. Well, there's not. That's
there's still nothing they can give you?
There's still nothing they can do. Wow. That's the tricky part, you know? I mean, and that's like maybe
you're just
going to
feel like shit for a little while.
You're going to feel like shit for a little while. I mean, that can maybe at some point be a where somebody, you know, might want to ask to go into treatment. But even then, it, like in the world of harm reduction, you don't want to force treatment upon the person in the, right then and there. Because then your chances of them, when they actually want to get in treatment, they'll be like, oh, remember when you those people tried to, you know, push me into doing whatever treatment thing.
So is a Cubano sandwich going to be good? Like what? I want to have an answer. I want to, like, do the right thing.
I wish I, if you... Yeah, if you...
Because living in Hollywood, I mean, obviously, my friends are a little older now, yeah. But this could happen to me in an Uber ride.
Absolutely. You know? You should have Narcan with you in the Uber.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
And they're free to get, right?
They're free to get, yeah.
Where's a good place to get them?
Best place to get it would be Community Health Project, Los Angeles. They're on Western, just south of Santa Monica. And you could look them up.
Hold on. I'm thinking Santa Monica. Western. Wait a second.
Like, you know where the Smart and Final is? Over there, on the other side of the street of Smart and Final.
Oh, there's a Taco Bell and a McDonald's.
Yep. So on the one block down. Yeah.
Okay. So by the Smart and Final.
Uh-huh. Community Health Project. You can literally pop in any Monday through Friday, and anybody can come in and say, "Hey, I want to get some Narcan," and they'll be given Narcan to have with them. And they'll even show you if you're like, "Hey, can you show me how to use this?" They'll take their time and they'll walk you through it, and they'll give you a demo and educate you on how to use the.
This is a great point. You're absolutely right. I definitely should have Narcan because I'm driving later at night now. I don't want to, but I just kind of have to.
Yeah.
I'm working all day. And you just never know who's going to get in your car.
You never know.
And you never know what they're going to do in the back of the car. So
you never know what they did. You never know what they did right before they walked down and got into that Uber. That's the other thing is like they don't have to be using IV drugs in the back of your car. They can take a pill when they get in. They could have just smoked and they get in the car. And when that, you know, and when that all settles in with the whatever benzos or whatever they did, whatever mix they have, and they sit down, then they could, you know, then you're like, oh, hey, but you know, you think they're taking a nap and they're, it's more than that.
Why do I keep thinking that the city could solve these problems? Maybe not solve, like, the root problem of why people take drugs. Because we take drugs because they make us feel great.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
that's their
plan. I had a kidney stone 20 years ago, and they gave me Demerol.
Mm-hmm.
And I had read, I mean, we love rock and roll. Mm-hmm. So I've read all these rock and roll bios, and all of our favorite people have done heroin.
Yeah.
All of them.
All of them.
Seems like. Maybe not Bruce Springsteen. Mm-hmm. Maybe. Mm-hmm. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, wait a second. I'm feeling exactly like the Basketball Diaries.
Mm-hmm.
You ever read that book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And I'm like, I'm feeling nauseous. I'm feeling really sleepy. I'm feeling on top of the world.
Yeah.
And now I'm asleep.
Yeah.
And I was like, Demerol is heroin. Those MFers.
Yeah.
And then I woke up and I puked. And then I apologized to every single nurse, even though I wasn't rude to them.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt so blissful that I felt almost ashamed at feeling so good. And so I apologized to all of them. And then I was like, I wish you guys had given me just a little less so that I could really have experienced it.
So you really enjoyed it, yeah.
Is the Basketball Diaries kind of like what heroin is like?
Yeah. Oh,
Lou
yeah.
Reed and heroin is that feeling?
Yeah, at first. And then that's the thing is like you feel it at first and it feels so good and like you know and it kind of takes it back to like the whole like 12 step thing, you know, and because you get this feeling and like, you know, a lot of the people use drugs because they've had something, you know, there's a hole inside of us, you know, and they'll you know, we could say it's a God sized hole, it's a, you know, like in Alcoholics Anonymous it's described as a spiritual malady, right? It's like it's an unrest inside of us, and when we take that first drink or we take that first, you know, hit of the dope or whatever it may be. It feels that you finally get to breathe, you get that calm, you know, and that's what addicts and alcoholics end up chasing, you know, and they chase that and chase that and chase that.
Yeah.
And we find, you know, in working the 12 steps and in the 12, you know, that at least for me, that's the only sufficient substitute that I've been able to find for chasing that feeling is like the feeling of helping others. And in a selfish way, it feels so good that you're like, oh, wow, like I feel great after sitting down and helping this guy, or like, oh, I feel great after, you know, going and volunteering with this organization and feeding the streets. Like, oh, I feel good. I feel it builds my self-esteem, right? So you want to keep doing more of that because it feels good, and it's the only thing that really is a sufficient substitute for the way that I felt when I was getting for that thing that I found that filled that hole inside of me.
Mm-hmm. let's talk about your podcast real quick. You talk about this kind of stuff.
We talk about this stuff, yeah.
What's your podcast called?
It's called It's All Bad.
It's All Bad.
It's All Bad, yeah. Yeah. It's called It's All Bad.
This is why I love punk rockers.
Yeah.
Because we're not afraid of the dark side.
Yeah.
We embrace the dark side.
Yeah, we embrace it.
Who were your favorite punkers growing up?
Oh, man, that's such a loaded question.
Why is it loaded?
I don't know, because it's so hard to say, because there's so many.
Were you a Black Fat Flag person? Were you like an 80s?
So I was born in the 80s. I was born in 85. Kay. So I was a little, I moved here in 92. So for me, it was like, yeah, it's hard. You know, that's a hard one to say. I can't say that I have a favorite. You know, I can't say that.
Did you go to a punk rock show that blew your mind? Because I have not. Unless we're talking about Gwar.
Have you
seen Gwar live? Yeah,
I've never seen him live, no.
Rollins opened for Gwar in 90 at the Palladium. And I got lucky that I got to interview Rollins. He didn't have a car, so he asked me to drive him around. And I was like, hell yeah, I'll drive you around. And so I forget who the opener was, but Gwar stole the show, obviously. But I feel like punk rock isn't awesome live all the time.
Yeah.
You know? Because you're not going to get a great guitar solo. Mm-hmm. A lot of the meatheads are just trying to hurt each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the energy is fun, but I don't know if I've gone to like a great punk rock show.
So I'll tell, okay, in recent years, I've gone, you know, I got back into punk because a few of my friends started that band Dead City Punks around COVID, you know, and they started doing these, they started playing shows on like the LA River. And when everything was locked down and there was no venues that were open, they were like, fuck this, we're just going to play shows. We're not going to charge anything for it. We're just going to show up. We're going to set up PA systems and we're going to play. And every time there's a police helicopter, there's fireworks, people, they're getting shot, rubber bullets shot at them, you know. And they put on the fucking greatest shows.
That
the greatest
sounds awesome.
Shows, yeah.
I think I've seen TikTok videos of that.
Yeah.
Like underneath like the 6th Street Bridge.
Yeah, the 6th Street Bridge, they did one, yeah. And it's cool because we came and they're friends of mine and they hit me up and they were like, hey, they're like, we want to be able to use this platform to help people. Hey, can we want to do like a video, like a harm reduction kind of, because we've lost so many friends to overdoses. They were like, hey, we want to do a little video like as a PSA for harm reduction. So they did a video on how to administer Narcan and how to spot an overdose, right? And they put it out as the band. The band did it, you know? And then they were playing the show, that 6th Street Bridge show, and I hit them up and I go, hey, I go, you guys can't be fucking putting out PSAs about Narcan and then not having Narcan at your shows, you know? And they were like, what the fuck? You want to bring Narcan to a show? And I was like, sure. So we started tabling their shows where now we do like, where now we have free Narcan and we do wound care at their shows because people, you know, people are getting shot with rubber bullets. People are jumping over fires.
Wound
and stuff.
Because of the cops?
Yeah. Wound care because of the cops. Or
not
because of
them, elbows
or
in
because
the pit?
Or because of them falling into a fire or them getting, you know, doing too many. A big thing with them is like a lot of the crowd does Nas, you know. That's a big thing where they do the Nas balloons.
Did you ever do any of that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What's crazy about that is I would have a friend that would buy
the tank.
And I would get into a little hole that felt like it was like 10 minutes long, but it was only a minute.
Yeah.
I just didn't. I was like, I feel like I'm hurting my own brain cells. I mean, I didn't stop.
Yeah.
But like, did I do it wrong?
No, that's it. You were doing it 100% right. Yeah. And that people just want to keep doing that.
Isn't
they want
the
to get
craziest
drug? It's crazy.
Although I will say this. At the tail end of an ecstasy trip?
That's where it's the best, yeah. Well, okay, and so, and Deadheads use it, they call it hippie crack, you know, because they do it.
That's who this guy was.
Yeah, so Deadheads, but now it kind of came back. There's been like a resurgence with these like punk, with the punk scene, with these like street punk graffiti thing that they came up and where they all do it there. And you'll see, I mean, you'll just see like outside of Echo Park Lake, you'll see like hundreds of canisters, or you'll see people, I'll be walking by and there's just guys broad daylight just with a tank hitting balloons.
Balloons, yeah.
We found out about it I must have been 15, 16 years old, and they would use it as for car stuff. They would use Nas, you know. So we knew a shop in somewhere in North Hollywood or in Van Nuys. There was a car shop where you could come in, and before we could we were like 15, 16 years old. We couldn't buy, you know, we couldn't buy alcohol. We couldn't really buy drugs yet. But we could get Nas, so we would go. That was the one thing that we could get, you know. And there would be kids. You'd see kids wearing their school uniforms coming in there getting these tanks filled up.
For $100, right?
It was like $60, yeah.
Right.
It was $1 a pound. So like
that
a 60-pound tank, yeah.
It was cheap.
It was cheap.
I think it's legal.
I think it's legal, yeah.
Because they sell the canisters at Party City.
Yeah. And it's for whipped cream, you know? So it's basically for whipped cream. Yeah. For whipped cream, yeah.
Do you think it should be legal? I don't.
I don't, yeah. I mean, that's the thing.
I'm a libertarian deep down. Mm-hmm. I'm a free loving, but I just don't. I don't see the goodness of it. Like weed, I think there's a goodness there. Ecstasy, for sure, there's a goodness. Yeah. But this, like, I don't know if it hurts. Do you think it hurts brain cells?
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
100%. I mean, working in treatment, you know, I worked in treatment for a while. And so I got to see, you know, we would see people that would come in from all kinds of various addictions, you know, and you'd see people come in with inhalant addictions. Like, you know, they were doing the dust off and we're doing stuff. And you would be like, man, it's so, because the difficulty for them is they can walk into anywhere and get it. And then the difficulty for us working in treatment was there's no way to detect it.
Right.
Yeah. So it can be, you can pass any drug test with it. You could be doing it. You can walk in, get it anywhere, you know?
I'll tell you how you can detect it. Leave a whipped cream can.
There you go. Yeah.
yeah. And see if they suck the whipped cream or they do it real gently just to get the gas. Yeah.
The true test.
But I might fail that test too. Because it is a fun little hack.
Yeah.
And remember, like, 99 Cent Store used to sell whipped cream for a buck.
Oh, yeah.
They jacked it up to, like, $4 once they got onto people. Okay. There's so many things I could ask you, Danny, but I think we need to wrap it up.
All right.
Thank you, first of all, for being so honest about everything. I will ask you this, because we are in this beautiful place of recovery, and I've had to deal with two different girlfriends who didn't really want to do all the right things all the time.
Yeah.
And I was nudged to go to Al-Anon, but I didn't want to do that because whatever. I just didn't want to go.
Yeah.
In retrospect, I wish I had gone because it's good to learn from experts. But one of the things that the first one told me that I had to use on the second one was she was like, sometimes you just got to push them out. You got to push them out of your life. You got to push them out of your apartment. You just got to let them truly hit rock bottom.
Yeah.
And they might not actually hit rock bottom if you're sitting there and coddling them and turning your back as they drink their drink or do whatever they're doing. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. You
Is
know,
that
it was
the hardest
thing
to do with loved ones?
The hardest thing. I mean, it took my mom doing that to me, you know, to really being like, hey, I love you and I'm here for you, but you can't, like, you can't come home for the holidays. You can't come, you know, I can't, like, I would show up and I'd be like, well, at least I can get a good meal and I could pass out on my mom's couch and kind of maybe get like $20 or $40 out of her on the holidays. And I remember showing up and her being like, hey, I love you. Here's some food, but you can't even come into the house. And I remember feeling, I was like, man, that's like, and I was just, and I was like, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean I can't? She goes, I love you, but at this, you know, like, I got to do this. I got to do this to protect you, my little brother, who was at the time, was like, you know, he was, he's 22, whatever. I don't know. I'm really bad at math. You know? But he was like 11 when I got sober, you know? So it was like really effective. He was starting to become aware of what was going on. And my mom did this thing where every time I would see her, like, she would go and meet me for lunch or we would hang out. And she'd always be like, let me get a photo with you. And I'd be like, mom, like, I look like shit. You know, I mean, I came in, I was 127 pounds. I was borderline on the street. You know, I looked, you know, 20 years older than I do right now. And she was like, let me just, and I was like, why do you always get these photos? You know, and she goes, because I don't know if this is the last photo that I'm going to get to take of my son. And man, like, and I remember hearing that and being like, oh, that, like, and I'm doing this to her, you know, and I can't stop. So when she finally was like, hey, I love you, but I'm going to love you from a distance. And when you want help, I'll be here for you and I'll help you however I can. And I think it was the thing that really, like, it was what I really needed. It was really what I really, really, truly needed, you know? So really any family member of anybody that, you know, that doesn't know what to do with their loved one that's drinking or, you know, the Al-Anon family groups is the most amazing, beautiful resource for that because first of all, you go there and you realize the family members go there and they realize that they're not alone in this thing, you know, because my mom, like, where we came from, she couldn't tell her coworkers what was going on. She couldn't tell her friends that, like, that her son was an opiate addict. She couldn't do that. She could not, you know, there was like so much shame and guilt in that. And then she would have to sit with it alone, you know. So when she started attending Al-Anon, when she started meeting with other parents and other, you know, it was the treatment center I went through. There was a family group where the family members would come and they'd have Al-Anon speakers and Al-Anon, like, sponsors come in and would work with them. And And she was like, it gave her a sense of community. It let her see that she wasn't alone in all of this. And it's maybe the most beautiful resource that the family members of the alcoholics and addicts have.
Well, I mean, especially if you're somebody like me who appreciates drugs,
yeah,
but for some reason never was cursed with that addictive thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, I went out once with my girlfriend when we were first starting to date, and she's like, so you're not going to finish that beer? And I was like, I don't know. I'm with a pretty girl. I don't really, we're not chugging.
Yeah.
And she's like, that beer would be gone if that was my beer. And I was like, I guess I'm lucky. Would you say that those of us who can handle our booze and drugs, are we the lucky ones? Are we the rare ones?
I used to think that you guys were the lucky ones. Yeah. But like, you know, that I have I had a friend that would say, you know, he's like, the way that I see recovery today is it's kind of like when you eat mushrooms, you know, you go and you find these mushrooms which grow on cow shit, right? Like, that's how we discovered mushrooms. Like, there was somebody that was like, look at this mushroom that grew on this cow shit and ate it and had this like beautiful psychedelic trip, right? Yes. And they were like, whoa, like, and they had this like spiritual experience, right? I feel like that we get the same thing, that those of us that are in recovery get that same thing, you know,
you do?
And that where we get that, where we go to these deep, dark places, you know, and we get to the point where we lose control, where we cannot stop drinking once we start. And once we start, we cannot stop, you know, so we can't stop. We can't stay stopped, and we can stop when we start. Right. And then we go to these places, and it takes us where it takes us, to homelessness, to, you know, to the things we do, to then be able to get these big, beautiful lives as a result of that. So it's really, I don't know, you know, I used to think that. I used to be like, man, everybody's so lucky that they could just do whatever, you know, but like,
yeah.
I'm grateful that I got to have all the, you know, that I got to go to all the shows that I did in Trip Balls and do, you know, and I got to see, you know, Dark Side of the Moon. We went the first time that they played Dark Side of the Moon at Hollywood Bowl. I went the first night I went on mushrooms, the second night I went on acid, the third night I went on opiates. And I had three completely different shows, you know, and I'm really stoked I got to do that. But I'm really grateful because of that. I have the life today, and I'm in a relationship with my girlfriend. I'm able to show up, and my mom gets to have a son that's there for her today, you know.
Well, we're grateful you made it too.
Yeah, thanks.
And thank goodness. What would you say? I would say thank God.
I'd say thank God. That's exactly what I'd say. Yeah.
Too. Uh-huh. Well, yeah. Thank God for God, and thank God for you, Danny.
Yeah. Thank God for you.
And Cafe Tropical, it's closed right now.
We're closed Mondays. We're closed Mondays.
You came here on your day off?
Yeah, I came here on my day off. Yeah. So we're open Tuesday through Sunday, 7 to 3. And then we do tropical wings, tropical wild wings, and ice cream on Friday night, 6 to about 10:30.
And so is the community room open?
Community room
every
is opening every day. Yep. And there's a schedule on the back. There's a schedule on the community room door, and we should have a schedule on our website soon too of the meetings as well.
But every day, every morning at 7.
Every morning at 7. There's
a
meeting.
And then generally, what's your latest meeting?
Latest meeting, I think there's a few days of the week we have an 8 o'clock meeting in the evening, and okay. Then yeah, various fellowships.
So if you think you just want to just listen, if you think you need it, I don't know, how would you put it? If you think this is the space for you,
Just come on in. Come check it out.
Oh, by the way, because you have this great baker here,
uh-huh.
I heard that on anniversaries in AA, you get a cake.
Yeah. Oh,
do
yeah.
you guys make AA cakes?
So they come. Well, they'll come and they'll usually get a pastry. They'll get a pastry from us, and then they'll have it back presented back there for whoever's getting the cake. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. So my mom to this day will still go purchase a cake and will bring it to me every year on my AA anniversary.
She will.
Yeah.
God, oh yeah. Is your mom like the happiest person
happiest.
You turn the corner?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Are you like, hey baby, now take a picture of me?
Yeah. Right. Me. Exactly. Yeah.
Danny, yeah. God bless you, man.
Yeah, God bless you, too. Thanks,
all right.
Tony.
How great was Danny? You know who we'd have a pastry with on a sunny day in Silver Lake? Our Patreons. When you stoke us, you're saying, Tony, I used to read those weed reviews in L.A. back in the day. Thank you. Here's some cash for always keeping it wholesome.
So shout out to our Patreons, Nancy Rommelman, Sean Atlow, Matt Mills, Sean Wallace, Greg and Molly, Jamie Taylor, Mark Johnson, Kira Ann, Barney Granke, Ben Welsh, Jen Adams, Trevor Wilson, Bree Wild, Dougie Gyro, Christina Up North, Robin Carey. Oh, by the way, it's Carrie's birthday today, or was it yesterday? Whichever. Happy birthday, Carrie. Adam Shorn, Ben from Down Under, Chris from the ATX, Gregor, and Phil. To be a Patreon, just go to patreon.com/hereinLA and give till it hurts. Want to support us, but you're saving some cash for a nice summer vacation? You can still help. Post your favorite episode on your Facebook. May as well start with this one. Tweet this link on your Twitter or on your Threads. Put it in your live journal for all I care. But tell your friends. Tell them how Here in LA is spelled, and then it's on Apple Podcasts and Google and even the YouTubes. Here in LA. Oh, you know what? I think Google is going to end their podcast soon. So we're also on Amazon. We're on all of them. Relax. Here in LA is produced by myself, Tony Pierce. Music supervision by Jordan Katz. Songs by Orgone and Jordan Katz. Special thanks to Cindy for creating the logo, Jen for inspiring this, and beautiful souls like Danny and his pals, who are helping others all the time and giving the good spirits of the universe a vehicle in which to work wonders through. Thank you, Perry.